Hi everyone, welcome back to the OrthoBullets podcast. In today's episode, we cover the topic of adult pyogenic vertebral osteomyelitis found under the spine section at orthobullets.com. Let's begin with a quick summary. Adult pyogenic vertebral osteomyelitis, also known as spondylodiscitis, represents a spectrum of spinal infections including discitis, epidural abscess, and vertebral osteomyelitis. Diagnosis is made with MRI studies with contrast. Treatment may be long-term targeted antibiotics alone or surgical decompression and stabilization, depending on the extent and chronicity of infection, location in the spine, and identification and susceptibility to antimicrobials of the pathogen. In terms of the epidemiology, remember that this is usually seen in adults, and the median age for pyogenic osteomyelitis is 50 to 60 years. In terms of the anatomic location, 50 to 60% of cases occur in the lumbar spine, 30 to 40% in the thoracic spine, and about 10% occur in the cervical spine. Risk factors include IV drug use, diabetes, recent systemic infection such as a UTI or pneumonia, malignancy, immunodeficiency or immunosuppressive medications, obesity, malnutrition. Remember that a serum albumin less than 3 grams per deciliter is indicative of malnutrition. Other risk factors include trauma and smoking. In terms of the pathophysiology, pathogens may include bacterial agents such as Staph aureus, which is the most common, and occurs in about 50 to 65% of cases. Staph epidermidis is the second most common cause. Gram-negative infections have been increasing over the last decade and are often associated with gram-negative infections of the GU and respiratory tract. Pseudomonas may be seen in patients with IV drug use. Salmonella is seen in patients with sickle cell disease, and other causes may include tuberculosis and fungal infections. In terms of the inoculation, there may be hematogenous seeding. It is generally agreed that inoculation likely occurs through hematogenous seeding of the end plates and intervertebral discs, either from an arterial or a venous source. Remember that end plates contain areas of low-flow vascular anastomosis, which may provide an environment suited for inoculation. An involvement of one end plate leads to direct extension into the intervertebral discs, followed by direct extension into the second end plate. There may be direct inoculation. This can occur after penetrating trauma, open fractures, and following surgical procedures. There may also be contiguous spread from local infection. This is most commonly associated with retropharyngeal and retroperitoneal abscesses. There is also sometimes neurologic involvement. There are neurologic deficits present in 10 to 20% of cases. This may result from direct infectious involvement of neural elements, compression from an epidural abscess, or compression from instability of the spine. Conditions that are associated include an epidural abscess. This is defined as a collection of pus or inflammatory granulation tissue between the dura mater and the surrounding adipose tissue. In terms of the epidemiology of an epidural abscess, remember that it is usually associated with vertebral osteomyelitis. It is present in about 18% of patients with spondylodiscitis, and 50% of patients with an epidural abscess will have neurologic symptoms. Other associated conditions include a psoas abscess. Moving on to the presentation, a patient's history will typically include a history of UTI, pneumonia, skin infection, or of organ transplant. In terms of symptoms, remember that fever is only present in about 1/3 of patients. Many will present with pain. Remember that pain is often severe and insidious in onset. It is usually worse with activity and unrelenting in nature. Also remember that pain that awakens patients at night should raise concern for malignancy and infection. Neurologic symptoms will be present in 10 to 20% of cases. This may include radiculopathy and myelopathy. And on exam, make sure to perform a careful neurological exam. In terms of imaging, radiographic findings are usually delayed by weeks. However, these may include paraspinous soft tissue swelling, which is evident with the loss of a psoas shadow. This is typically seen in the first few days. There may be disc-based narrowing and disc destruction seen at 7 to 10 days, and remember that disc destruction is atypical of a neoplasm. There may be end plate erosion or sclerosis seen at 10 to 21 days, and one may also note local osteopenia. A CT may be useful to show bony abnormalities, abscess formation, and extent of bony involvement. MRI with gadolinium contrast is indicated as the gold standard for diagnosis and treatment. It is the most sensitive and specific imaging modality for diagnosis of spinal osteomyelitis. It has a sensitivity of 96% and specificity of 93%. It is also the most specific imaging modality to differentiate from tumors. In terms of timing, remember that if it is performed early, findings may be interpreted as degenerative changes, so a repeat MRI to see progression may be required. Findings may include paraspinal and epidural inflammation, disc and endplate enhancement with gadolinium, and a T2 weighted hyperintensity of the disc and endplate, which may demonstrate rim enhancing. A technetium TC99M bone scan is indicated in patients who cannot obtain an MRI. It is 90% sensitive but lacks specificity. A combined technetium TC99M and gallium 67 scan is both more specific and more sensitive than technetium TC99M alone. And an indium 111 labeled scan is not recommended due to a poor sensitivity of 17%. In terms of laboratory studies, white blood cells will be elevated in only about 50% of patients, so this is not a sensitive indicator for early infection. ESR is elevated in 90% of cases, and it can be monitored serially to track successive treatment. However, it is considered less reliable than CRP. CRP is also elevated in about 90% of cases. This can also be monitored serially to track successive treatment and is considered more reliable than ESR. Blood cultures are indicated in all patients prior to antibiotic administration if an organism is unknown. Remember that identification of the organism is mandatory for treatment. In terms of the sensitivity and specificity, this is the least invasive method to determine a diagnosis. About 33% of patients with spondylodiscitis have positive blood cultures. When they are positive, 85% of these are accurate for isolating the correct organism. Remember that blood culture yield is improved by withholding antibiotics and obtaining cultures when the patient is febrile. A CT-guided biopsy is indicated in patients who do not have indications for immediate open surgery and blood cultures are negative. It can provide a diagnosis in 68 to 86% of patients. The biopsy may be guided by fluoroscopy or by CT scan, and culture should be sent for aerobic, anaerobic, fungal, and acid-fast cultures. An open biopsy is indicated when a tissue or organism diagnosis cannot be made with non-invasive techniques. The specific technique may involve an anterior, costo-transversectomy, or transpedicular approach. In terms of the differential, make sure to think about spinal tumors. Remember that MRI is the most specific imaging modality to differentiate from tumors, and features that weigh towards an infection include disc space involvement, endplate erosion, and significant inflammation. In terms of treatment, non-operative options include immediate broad-spectrum antibiotics. This is indicated in critically ill patients who are septic. Remember that one must obtain Gram stains and cultures first and then start antibiotics, so one should consider immediate CT-guided aspiration prior to administration of IV antibiotics. However, one will not be able to wait for culture results before starting broad-spectrum antibiotics. One should use vancomycin for penicillin-resistant and gram-positive bacteria, as well as a third-generation cephalosporin for gram-negative coverage. Another option is organism-specific antibiotics for 6 to 12 weeks with or without bracing. This is indicated for lumbar vertebral osteomyelitis. However, the organism must be identified and sensitive to antibiotics. And this is controversial, as some argue that surgical debridement is needed. The bracing helps to improve pain and prevent deformity. Remember that a rigid cervical thoracic orthosis or halo is required for cervical osteomyelitis. In terms of the antibiotics, these are indicated once the organism has been identified via blood culture or biopsy. This is usually treated with IV culture-directed antibiotics until signs of improvement, which may require 4 to 6 weeks of treatment, and then the patient is converted to PO antibiotics. In terms of resistant strains, new antibiotic-resistant strains of microorganisms are becoming more common, and failure to diagnose can have negative consequences. These organisms may include methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, vancomycin-resistant Staph aureus, and vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus. Newer generation antibiotics for antibiotic-resistant organisms include linezolid and daptomycin. This approach is successful in about 80% of cases. Operative treatment options include an open biopsy alone. This is indicated when cultures and CT-guided biopsy fail to provide a pathogen. It is also indicated in lumbar disease without an abscess formation in the canal. The specific technique may involve a transpedicular or kyphoplasty-like approach. Another operative option is neurologic decompression, surgical debridement, and spinal stabilization. This is indicated in cervical vertebral osteomyelitis with progressive neurologic deficits, in the case of progressive deformity and gross spinal instability, in refractory cases, and if there is a large abscess formation. The specific technique is dictated by the characteristics of the pathology. anterior debridement and strut grafting with or without posterior instrumentation is considered the gold standard. Posterior debridement and decompression alone is usually ineffective for debridement, however, it may be indicated in some cases. Now let's discuss the technique for anterior debridement and strut grafting with or without posterior instrumentation in more detail. The goals are to identify the organism, eliminate infection, prevent or improve neurologic deficits, and maintain spinal stability. In terms of the strut graft selection, autogenous tricortical iliac crest, rib, or fibula strut grafts have been proven to be safe and effective in the presence of acute infection. Allograft is being used with good results, but autogenous sources theoretically have better incorporation. Furthermore, a recent study showed improved deformity correction with titanium mesh cages filled with autograft, followed by posterior instrumentation. In terms of the instrumentation, spinal instrumentation in the presence of active infection is controversial. Some advocate for IND followed by a staged instrumentation. However, some advocate a single procedure with bone graft and instrumentation in the presence of an active infection. Also remember that titanium is preferred over stainless steel. In terms of posterior instrumentation, remember that this is indicated when severe kyphotic deformity or a multi-level anterior construct is required, and posterior instrumentation can be performed at the same time or as a staged procedure. Now that we've discussed the major points relating to adult pyogenic vertebral osteomyelitis, let's walk through some questions to apply what we've learned and get a sense of how the topic might be tested. For the first question, consider the following clinical scenario. You are asked to evaluate a 17-year-old female with complaints of low back pain for the last 2 months. The patient was previously admitted for pyelonephritis and treated with IV antibiotics. She has a low-grade fever and is hemodynamically normal. On exam, she has paraspinal tenderness and spasm at the lumbar levels. She does not have any extremity pain or neurological symptoms. Her neurological exam is unremarkable. However, you do notice that she has worsening of pain with sitting or standing, but the pain improves when she lies flat. Her CRP and ESR are both elevated. Her radiographs of the lumbar spine show paraspinous soft tissue swelling and disc space narrowing of the L3-L4 disc space. Of the options listed, what is the best next step? And the answer choices are, choice 1, order a spine CT with contrast and initiate broad-spectrum antibiotics. Choice 2, MRI of the spine with contrast and obtain image-guided aspiration biopsy or culture. Choice 3, take the patient for urgent surgical debridement with intraoperative cultures. Choice 4, MRI of the spine with contrast and collection of blood cultures. Choice 5, collect blood cultures and initiate broad-spectrum antibiotics. The best answer to this question is choice 4, MRI of the spine with contrast and collection of blood cultures. When there is suspicion of a spine infection in a hemodynamically normal patient without neurologic compromise, the collection of bacterial, both aerobic and anaerobic blood cultures, to establish a microbiological diagnosis is recommended prior to initiating antimicrobial therapy. Spinal infections are caused by direct inoculation, contiguous spread, or by hematogenous spread. Pyogenic vertebral osteomyelitis risk factors include recent systemic infections, IV drug use, diabetes, immunodeficiency, malnutrition, malignancy, trauma, and smoking. Of those diagnosed with pyogenic vertebral osteomyelitis, an associated epidural abscess is present in about 18% of cases. Spinal infections can have an insidious onset with relatively benign physical exams. Identification of the offending infectious agent should be identified prior to the start of antimicrobial therapy. This should be first attempted with blood cultures. When a microbiological diagnosis cannot be confirmed with blood cultures alone, then the recommendation is to perform an image-guided aspiration biopsy and culture, or perform open surgical biopsy if the patient has a normal and stable neurological exam and stable hemodynamics. Surgical indications include progressive neurological deficits, worsening deformity, and spinal deformity despite appropriate antimicrobial therapy. The publication by Barberi et al. Published the 2015 Infectious Disease Society of America Clinical Practice Guidelines for the Diagnosis and Treatment of Native Vertebral Osteomyelitis in Adults. These guidelines have been applied to the pediatric population as well. An emphasis is placed on identifying the microbiologic diagnosis prior to initiating antimicrobial therapy, except in septic patients and/or patients with neurologic compromise. The publication by Cornett et al. Published a review on the evaluation and management of bacterial spine infections in adults. they review the associated risk factors, physical exam findings, diagnostic workup, and treatment options. They recommend identification of the causative organism prior to initiating antimicrobial therapy in the non-septic patient without neurologic compromise. The initial workup should include CBC, CRP, ESR, and two sets of blood cultures. If the blood cultures are negative and there have not been any changes in the patient's condition, then an image-guided biopsy should be performed, if possible. Let's also discuss why the other choices are incorrect. Choice 1. MRI of the spine with gadolinium is the modality of choice when there is suspicion of spinal infection. Choice 2. Blood cultures may only be positive 30% of the time. However, they are the least invasive and should be attempted prior to any other more invasive means. Choice 3. The patient is hemodynamically normal and does not have any findings concerning for neurologic compromise. Choice 5. Antimicrobial therapy should be initiated after a microbiologic diagnosis is made to help direct therapy if the patient remains stable. For the second question, consider the following clinical scenario. Amphotericin B is most appropriate for the treatment of which type of spine infection? And the answer choices are: Choice 1, fungal osteomyelitis. Choice 2, bacterial osteomyelitis with a gram-positive organism. Choice 3, bacterial osteomyelitis with a gram-negative organism. Choice 4, tuberculous osteomyelitis. Or choice 5, viral meningomyelitis. The best answer to this question is choice 1, fungal osteomyelitis. Amphotericin B would be most appropriate for the treatment of fungal infections of the spine. Amphotericin B is a broad-spectrum antifungal medication. It is commonly used as first-line agent for treatment of fungal infections of the spine. The most common fungi involving the spine include Cryptococcus, Candida, and Aspergillus. The indications for debridement and stabilization with spinal fusion include resistance to antibiotic therapy, spinal instability, and or neurologic deficits. The publication by Kim et al. Reviewed fungal infections of the spine. They comment that fungus infections are most commonly spread by hematogenous or direct spread. Access to the vascular system may include intravenous lines, during implantation of prosthetic devices, or during surgery. The publication by Frazier et al. Retrospectively reviewed 11 patients with fungal osteomyelitis of the spine. 9 of the patients were immunocompromised, secondary to diabetes mellitus, corticosteroid use, chemotherapy for a tumor, or malnutrition. All were treated with antifungal medication. 10 of 11 patients were also treated with surgical debridement. Paralysis secondary to the spine infection developed in 8 patients. After an average of 6.3 years of follow-up, the infection had resolved in all 9 surviving patients. Let's also discuss why the other choices are incorrect. Choice 2. Cefazolin and vancomycin may be used for the treatment of bacterial osteomyelitis with gram-positive organisms. Choice 3. Fluoroquinolone, such as ciprofloxacin, may be used for the treatment of bacterial osteomyelitis with a gram-negative organism. Choice 4. Combination treatment with isoniazid, ethambutol, rifampin, and pyrazinamide is used for the treatment of tuberculous osteomyelitis. Choice 5. Treatment of viral meningomyelitis will be dependent of the viral organism. That's all for this review about adult pyogenic vertebral osteomyelitis. We hope that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session from OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. As a reminder, you can follow along with these podcast episodes by reviewing the topics directly on orthobullets.com. You can listen to these episodes on the OrthoBullets website or phone app while reading through the topic. If the OrthoBullets podcast has been valuable to you, we'd be thrilled if you consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow, right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.